Hello and welcome to episode 9 of the Chills at Will podcast. I'm so excited to have a different format today, as I'm honored to be joined by Claudia Monpere McIsaac, whose beautiful short story, All Sweet Things Float, is the focus of this episode. How many times have you read a great story and wanted to talk to the writer herself? Well, I get my chance today to talk to a great writer, who also happens to have been a formative and transformative professor for me during my days at Santa Clara University. You're in for a treat today, as we'll talk about the writing life in general and the mechanisms and profundity of All Sweet Things Float in particular. I've been so drawn to this story, especially for its quietly beautiful ending with its mesmerizing imagery, and we'll get a chance to do a close read of this ending. Good morning, Claudia. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Thank you so much for joining me. So again, we have Claudia Monpere McIsaac, and she writes under Claudia Monpere. She was my teacher in a poetry class and a fiction class at Santa Clara, and she writes fiction, poetry, and memoir. Her work appears in many anthologies and literary magazines, including The Kenyon Review. Did I say that right? Kenyon Review?
That's right, yeah. Huh.
The New Ohio Review, The Cincinnati Review, and River Teeth. Some awards include the Georgetown Review Fiction Award and a Hedgebrook Residency. And she's taught at Santa Clara University for many years, including this during this time of distance learning, huh?
Yeah, you bet.
I would guess that's the first time you've done it that way.
Well, I taught a creative nonfiction class online last summer.
Okay.
And the summer before. And I was required to have a lot of training in order to do that. And boy, I would be in real hot water now if I hadn't had that training.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
But it was still a challenge because the courses I've been teaching now, I've never taught online before. So it was,
right,
you know, definitely a transition.
Anything else you'd like to add about your publications or certifications or awards?
No, just as we have our conversation about the story, I'm sure things will come out.
Excellent.
Yeah, thank you for that introduction.
Yeah. Like I said, I was so lucky to have you for those two classes. And, you know, I am a teacher myself. I've been an English and Spanish teacher for 17 years. And I still teach many of those stories that I, you know, maybe would have never read except for your class. Including, of course, Bullet in the Brain, which is pretty much the inspiration for this whole podcast.
I love that you teach Bullet in the Brain. That is one of my all-time favorite stories ever, and makes me really happy that you read it in my class and that it touched you so deeply that you teach it now.
Well, I mean, the nostalgia factor of that story is incredible, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's just, I could go on for hours about that. and you know, the title is a little bit off-putting. It's a little hard to teach maybe, but you know, with the title, but then you get into it and you realize that it's actually a sweet story.
Oh, it's a really sweet story.
Right?
Remarkable what Wolf does with time in that story.
Oh, exactly. You know, whoever thought a story about a bank robbery and a shooting would
lead
to such. Oh man. One of the main things I appreciate about you is that you were a teacher first. You know, we've all, I think, had those professors who, they're kind of, being a professor is kind of secondary. They do their thing, they publish, they, you know, have, you know, whatever, off to the side. But, you know, you were clearly a teacher first, and you really gave us great feedback.
Thank you.
You know, I'm an amateur. I'm not a college professor. The publish or perish phrase, was that ever true? Is that not as true anymore?
I think it's acutely true, more true now maybe than ever.
Wow.
For professors, because the job market is just ridiculously competitive. And so people who might have been able to get tenure 10 or 15 years ago because they had a couple really terrific articles in great journals wouldn't be able to now unless they had maybe a book published or you know, 8 articles in prestigious journals. So it's pretty nuts.
Wow.
I don't have tenure. I'm a senior lecturer. And so I never had that same kind of pressure on me. And I'm really glad I didn't, because that's allowed me to write what I want to write. It's allowed me to write poetry and fiction and creative nonfiction. If I'd been tenure track, you know, I would have been sort of seen as a fiction writer or a poet or what some particular category. And I would have had to make sure I really focused on that so that I could get tenure in that category. So, so kind of a nice thing of not, I mean, it would be cool. I would love it if I had tenure, but a nice thing about being a senior lecturer is I didn't have to go through that sense that I had to only write when I knew people wanted me to write.
Sure.
Yeah, I love basically the whole range of courses I teach. I also teach freshman comp, and that's just a real delight.
Oh, okay. Oh, nice. Nice. So the idea of the workshop, right?
Yeah.
I know is pretty specific to writing courses. In your class, so I came in with my first, I think maybe two stories we had to workshop in the semester. Does that sound like what you normally do, or?
Yeah, I'm. Well, we're on the quarter system at
I'm sorry, quarter, right.
But yeah, we probably did two stories. It's hard to remember back then. But sure. But workshopping is a really important part of creative writing courses.
Well, you know, for mine, you know, I don't know, maybe 3 weeks in or so, and so I've seen a few students go through it, and I had my story ready, and I was confident. I was, you know. This is going to be no big deal. You know, correct me if I'm wrong here. The idea of the workshop is basically, all right, so I know that I'm going on, you know, whatever, May 5th. And so May 3rd, the previous class, I'm going to have copies of the story for everyone in the class, including the professor, right?
Yeah.
Students read it. They come in prepared with their comments and feedback. And there we go, right?
Exactly.
You know, it is a little bit of, I mean, it's obviously can be nerve-wracking. Where I don't know if you had us, I don't remember if it was set up with a classroom or if you had us like literally facing everyone.
I think we sit in a circle in workshop.
Okay. I'm guessing
that that's what we did. And I do my best to try to make them, you know, friendly, inviting spaces that aren't overly judgmental. It's, mm-hmm. it's tricky because you want people to learn from the responses that their peers give, but you also want people to feel, you know, nurtured and understood and to see what is working with a piece of writing. Mm-hmm.
And I would think that your workshop would be different in like an advanced fiction class where they're more of their own volition rather than just kind of taking a.
Yeah. I mean, and sometimes it's nice just to have people read what they wrote and just clap or say I really enjoyed it or everybody says one or two things they really like about it. I have experimented more recently with different sort of formats of sharing writing so that everything isn't a full blown workshop. There's different ways to respond.
I remember in your poetry workshop, it was something like that. I think maybe we'd written a poem in class and it was short and it was something you could read in, you know, a minute. And you went, I think every single student went. And I remember this one girl read, and hers was kind of very stereotypical, like positive and flowers and nature. And it was nice. You say, congratulations, you know, good job. And we move on to the next. The next student was one of the darkest poems I've ever heard in my life.
Oh.
And he was great at presenting it. He, you know, the passion and the whole deal. And it was one of those that was, it was a great poem. It was just such a stark contrast to the previous one.
Yeah.
And I remember there was like a palpable silence and you just, oh, thank you. And you were equally, you know, thanking him as much as everyone else. It was pretty fun to see that contrast. It was kind of cool that would be allowed for in a class like that.
That's something I love about creative writing is that it's just an invitation to use your voice in whatever way you want. And, you know, people can write about personal trauma if they want, or they can write about things that bring them joy. I always tell students there's only one rule with creative writing, and that's write so that the reader will want to keep reading. Mm-hmm. There's really no, this is what you should do, or this is what you should avoid. I used to think that. I mean, and there are certain principles that are generally true, like use details and specificity. I mean, that's generally true, but sometimes it's better not to. So now I always say, hey, if you have this idea you want to try, you know, go for it. Just remember the goal is to keep a reader turning the page.
Sure.
Or the screen or whatever.
Right, right. Did you go through an MFA program?
I did. And it was
Did you feel like it was formulaic the way they taught, or?
It was a wonderful program. I got my MFA at San Francisco State. A downside was that I was writing primarily narrative poetry, and people didn't like narrative poetry then, and they sort of dismissed it. And so I tried really hard to write non-narrative poetry and tried to make myself into a completely different kind of poet. And then many years later now, I'm way more comfortable trying different forms and right. writing narrative if I want to. But it gave me, there were some wonderful, wonderful professors there. Frances Mays was just a brilliant professor.
Oh, wow. Okay.
She wrote Under the Tuscan Sun, and I took uh-huh. all her courses, and I did a couple independent studies with her. She was really encouraging, and she also knew how to hone in on exactly what wasn't working. But when my first fiction writing workshop was kind of a disaster, uh-huh. Because I wasn't a fiction writer, really. I was more a poet.
Okay.
And the only reason I took a fiction workshop is because I couldn't get the childcare to work out with the poetry classes. So I took a fiction workshop, and the professor called me into her office and said, gee, I'm thinking you might want to drop this class. Drop this class and take playwriting instead. Because I'd been a theater arts major from my bachelor's, and I'd written plays. And so my story was almost all dialogue. I mean, I said, no, I got to stay in this class because of the childcare.
Oh, my.
And then I went and just read, tried to educate myself in writing short fiction. And Alice Munro and Tobias Wolff were my teachers. I just read everything they'd ever written. And Chekhov, too.
Oh, yeah.
So I went to people whose work I read a little of, and I just really schooled myself deeply in how they created a plot, how they developed characters, you know, how did they write so that everything wasn't just dialogue.
Well, that makes us want to be fiction writers feel good that you, it didn't come naturally necessarily.
No, it didn't. It didn't at all. No.
Yeah. That is good to know. So you were talking about like your own classes and, you know, so, like I was saying, that first workshop I came in, I wasn't really nervous. I had a piece that I wrote. It was about a son's close relationship with his mom. And it was, you know, I hold my mom on a huge pedestal. It was, you know, it was basically autobiography, but I don't know, it was 75% autobiography kind of thing, right? And I was sure that I would knock everyone's socks off, right? So we get in that day, and it's like, I'm not going to overstate it. It wasn't a nightmare, but it was like, there was a lot of picking at my story by the fellow students. And I remember I was just, you know, I felt personally attacked because even though it's supposed to be fiction, it was kind of autobiography, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I even remember getting kind of petty, like in my mind, there happened to be a basketball player in there, you know, he's on the team. And I was, as he was kind of like saying something that was legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
About my story, but at the time I was attacked, I was like, oh, you know, well, you didn't play that well last night, you know, that kind of stuff.
<That's>
And the thing is that these comments, and you talked about fostering a good environment in class, you definitely did. There was nothing out of bounds that the students did.
Yeah.
And they were right on. They were totally right. It took me, you know, I don't know, a day or two, because I did feel like personally attacked, because, you know, anytime, obviously, you write something that's personal, you feel like it's an attack on you, but they were so right. It wasn't a good fiction piece. It had some good pieces maybe, but it didn't work. You know, it was thinly veiled fiction. And so that was a tough experience for me, but it was really beneficial for sure.
Oh, I'm sure glad. I think it's really painful for most people the first few times mm-hmm. that people respond to something they really worked hard on, and then they don't get the response they want. It's painful.
Right. Right. And yeah, when you say worked hard, I mean, I did work hard, but I think in hearing all the constructive criticism, I knew like I could have worked harder for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought like I kind of arrived like, oh, we're good.
Yeah. Yeah.
The idea of, I might be butchering the phrase, but I've heard it before. It said something like, the only thing that makes a rough draft a final draft is a due date.
Oh, that's great.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, so there's, you know, even pieces that I wrote later that I'll talk about in a second that, you know, got published, I still read and say, hey, there's things I could have changed for sure.
Yeah. I think that's, oh my gosh, I think that's true of all writers. I mean, right. Sometimes you'll be at a poetry reading or something and the person's reading a poem and then will suddenly change, you know, I'll find out later that the person changed a word or line just right there at the last minute there.
Wow, that's interesting. Definitely. So that was my first workshop. And the second then, you know, I was determined to do much better after I, you know, kind of it all sunk in and I decided like, yeah, they were right. And there's a lot of improvements to make. And I had, and it was, again, it was thanks to one of your class activities, actually. Yeah. You passed out a strip of paper to everyone and they were the openings, the beginnings of a story. And I might be conflating two activities, but I think you said to like keep the pen on the page for a minute, maybe, and just write and finish. Yeah. So it was, you know, it'd be something like mine was all along. I knew it was him.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that line.
Yes. Yeah. And so it was dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
And so it was dot, dot, dot. And we had to write on it. Right. And I, for whatever reason, that hit me so well. And I rolled with it. And, you know, it was one of the rare times in my life. And again, I'm not even close to being an accomplished writer. It was one of the rare times where I just rolled with it. And I think it ended up being, you know, 12, 13 pages. I probably, not that I wrote it all in that class.
Yeah.
But I was so inspired and I went home and, you know, and it ended up, you know, being published in different journals and it got a lot of, when it was workshopped, this, you know, the second time, it got a lot of positivity, a lot of positive comments. And it was all from that, all along I knew it was him.
Isn't that remarkable how one line can trigger a whole story?
Totally. And for me, it was so important because, you know, the idea of write what you know or don't follow that or however people fall, like some of the insignificant details were true to my life, you know, in this story that I wrote, but it was very dark. I wasn't in a dark place at that time. It was something that was totally organic, I feel like.
Oh.
And
you didn't necessarily set out to write the story you ended up writing.
Not at all. Not at all. And, you know, when people talk about like a story kind of having a life of its own, like I do feel like it was that. And to hear students in the workshop talk about my characters as if they were real people.
Oh.
Right? And it's
that
like,
must have been exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And so, and that was such a huge thing for me that it was like, you know, it's like art for the sake of art, writing for the sake of writing. It wasn't that thinly veiled autobiography that I wrote the first time around that, you know, maybe had its place somewhere else, but it wasn't fiction. So that was something that really inspired me to continue writing and change the way that I read even, you know. So do you remember that activity? Do you still do something similar or?
Oh yeah, I do. And then sometimes I change up the lines, the beginning lines. And yeah, it's a great activity. Students seem to really like it. And I do quite a bit of work with flash fiction in my classes now. Mm-hmm. And that activity is great for flash fiction because sometimes people get almost an entire piece. And I have them, I think when we do it, we write for 10 or 15 minutes.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a great activity. And it's something I imagine maybe you've used it already with high school students that they might enjoy too.
I have. So I use that. And I don't know if I had the other sentence starters that you had or if I remembered them partially or whatever, but I do have my list of, you know, 10 or 12.
Yeah.
And I definitely use them. In recent years with Common Core and kind of less emphasis on creative writing.
Yeah.
That is something I don't do as much of, but I use it a lot for personal narrative.
Oh, that's great.
Right? Because, you know, some students, and I found it to be so successful, some students know right away what they're going to write about, and that's no problem. But I've definitely seen with your activity, the free ride of sorts, it's, there's some who had no idea what they're going to write about, and then, you know, 20 minutes later, they've got a paragraph, or even just, I tell them, you know, hey, if from this 15-minute activity, even if you get one sentence you're going to use, it's a success.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right? And so, I know that's hard for for even me to say as a writer, and it's tough for them to say as writers, but it's very crucial.
Yeah. So
thank you for that activity.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm so glad you use it.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, it was one of the first times where it felt like it was a creation in itself, you know? It had legs on its own, and that was just such a cool feeling.
Yeah.
How do you help students to differentiate between autobiography and fiction? Do you see that to be a problem or an issue? Or does it matter?
When I teach fiction courses, I really encourage my students to draw on their own lives, but not too much. I encourage them to draw on emotions that they've had. Mm-hmm. I think that's really a critical thing for us to do as writers, you know, remember times of deep loneliness or awe or curiosity. I encourage them to draw on true events that they're willing to change in pretty major ways. Right. I really encourage them to draw on settings that they're familiar with. I think a rich setting, for me at least as a reader, is really important in most of the fiction that I enjoy reading. And I do these early activities where they kind of make lists of settings that they know really well. A lake in the mountains or a schoolyard from elementary school. But then I think it's really tricky when people try to write fiction, but they have this event they want to tell,
right,
or this point they want to make. Then I think it's way better to just call it nonfiction or memoir or creative nonfiction and just go with that. Because when fiction is, usually when people write fiction and they're trying too hard to make it close to what happened, it gets in the way of the creative process.
Sure.
Completely. So yeah, like I said, I would say hone in on your own emotions and one thing that I find can be really helpful with students is to think of, you know, because in fiction we want our readers to feel, right? We're not just writing so that they'll learn something.
Sure.
We want them to feel and to feel deeply. And so one thing that's been helpful for students is that I talk to them about remembering times when they felt deeply, deep anger or deep loneliness or whatever, and then exaggerate, push that feeling even farther, and then imagine the different things that could happen. And I share with them a real event that triggered a story in me, but I didn't do what the character in the story did. I was driving my daughter, she was a little girl then, with her friends, and they were all like bluebirds or campfire girls or something like that. And so we were all driving together to a meeting, and then I slowed down for an old woman who was at the crosswalk, and she was walking very slowly with a cane. Behind me was a young man in a car, impatient that I had stopped. I don't know if he noticed the woman or not, but he began honking at me, and then he scooted around me into the oncoming traffic lane and just sped off, and he almost hit the woman. I mean, she was fine. But I was so angry that I, you know, blasted my horn and I kind of yelled at him, and then I said to the girls, oh, don't worry that I said the F word. That's not really supposed to do that. But, and then, you know, I went on to what we were going to do, but that event didn't, it kind of haunted me. And I ended up writing a story about that begins kind of the same way the real event began. But what the woman does is chase the man, chase the young man. And then the story continues from right there. So I use that as an example in my class of a time when I felt great emotion. You know, I was worried about these kids in my car. I was worried about the old woman. I was mad at the man. And then I did what most people would do, which is, you know, you get kind of mad for a minute and then you forget about it.
Right.
So take that. And then where could a character do with that? That would, right, a reader would want to read.
Wow.
So that's a really kind of fun writing technique, a way to get ideas.
Great story to get their attention for sure.
Yeah.
Wow. I was talking about, you know, you talked a little bit about the idea of like with criticism in a workshop, or you as a writer, I'm sure that you informally or formally do workshops or share with your writer friends. How do you give constructive criticism to fellow writers, professionals and such? How do you take it? Well,
I have a couple writers groups that I've worked with for a really long time, and we all trust each other a lot. And so I think we're all pretty comfortable being honest, and we all make, you know, we all make a real effort to begin with praise. Mm-hmm. So I feel really good about the groups I'm in. I'm in a fiction, it's a prose group, and we write fiction and memoir. And then I'm in a poetry group. But there definitely are times, like I had a story I was really proud of, and I loved the ending. And a couple people in the group just hated the ending. It was really hard to sit there and hear them talk about hating the ending. Yeah. And but then someone spoke up and said, "Oh, don't change it. I love it. It's the perfect ending because blah, blah, blah." Uh-huh. And so then what you have to do as a writer is you have to decide, you know, which voices are telling you what you think is true and which voices are offering an opinion that,
right,
that you don't want to take, that you don't, you know, and it can be tricky because sometimes, you know, the Faulkner's line that kill your darlings, and sometimes you work so hard on a particular passage, you don't want to get rid of it.
Right.
So I feel really good about the groups that I'm in, but I've been in groups over the years, different groups where, you know, I was in one group where someone made someone cry by being overly critical, and another group where someone was extremely self-absorbed and we'd spent a really long time on this person's novel draft, 2 entire 3-hour sessions. So a total of 6 hours.
Whoa.
And then the person quit the group, right? after that. So, but I think if you can, I think it's really, for me, at least as a writer, it's really critical for me to have a community of writers who read my work and then I read their work. It's so hard. Writing is just really hard. It's easy to write badly, but to write well is so hard that I need like that kick in the butt of knowing I have deadlines and people who are counting on me reading my draft and so on. So,
You talk about deadlines, like particularly during this pandemic time. Do you have a daily schedule for writing? Are you the type like, hey?
I've been trying to write a friend of mine in my poetry group has been writing a poem a day, and she's been really, really good at it. And then she shares it with us, and we just email just a quick, you know, hey, I love this line or something. So I tried doing that, but there was no way I could draft a poem a day. Mm-hmm. But I try to draft a poem or two a week. But my schedule, probably like many of us, has been really wacky because I have family members who I'm needing to help. And my teaching is actually taking longer because I'm having to turn these classes online that weren't online. So, but I feel like it's really, really critical to write during this space, and with the recent tragedy of George Floyd's murder, I was really steeped in COVID stuff, but now I'm just feeling like should my voice be as a white woman? But so it's kind of informing some of the writing that I'm doing, but you know, but not all of it,
right?
And I noticed I taught advanced poetry this quarter. The quarter is just about over now. And there was just such a hunger in students for writing, such an incredible hunger. I mean, they wrote an amazing amount of poetry. I was really impressed.
Is it too small of a sample size, or have you seen writing based on Black Lives Matter, George Floyd? Or is that just too
soon? I've seen just a little bit online, you know, that people are sharing, And I think it's, one of my students wrote an amazing poem, and I don't think she shared it with the class. I think it was sort of toward the end of the term, but you know, some writers can be steeped in the moment and get material from that, and then other writers really need time to process.
Sure.
But I'm sure we'll see. I mean, there are so many remarkable poets and nonfiction writers and fiction writers of color. I know we'll be seeing some really remarkable work coming out.
Definitely. Do you feel that, you know, teaching, you said you teach, is it freshman comp this term?
Yeah, I'm teaching freshman comp, and then I'm teaching an advanced fiction writing class.
Okay. Just, you know, I know as an English teacher, same thing. Do you feel like you get to know students much more than, let's say, I guess it depends on the individual teacher, but just through their writing, you know, even more so than an engineering professor or business?
Probably. I mean, just because students reveal so much about themselves, especially in creative writing classes, but even in freshman writing, I really encourage students to reveal things about themselves that they're comfortable doing, because it always makes writing more interesting. Even if they're writing something that's pretty academic, I show them ways to incorporate a little bit of personal experience. I think all of us who teach writing, you know, if we're open to it, get to know our students pretty well and pretty deeply.
Yeah, and you know, 99% of me feels lucky. You know, there are times where I feel like, I wish I didn't know that about him or her, you know?
It can be tricky. I feel like when I was younger, it was hard for me to keep boundaries in terms of students who were really, really needy, in terms of wanting me to see multiple drafts of their work, or students who were really having trouble at home or something. And
right.
I realized that, and even though I would encourage them to go to counseling, you know, I probably sat in my office too long listening and trying to help.
That makes sense. What do you think of, you're talking about your students being so hungry to write, you know, especially recently. What do you think of this idea that, you know, no one reads anymore? Is that overblown? Is it people just read differently now?
Yeah, I think people read a lot. I mean, I think people read huge amounts. It's just that they're reading in a different way, and they're reading different kinds of material. I mean, long form writing just isn't appealing to a lot of people. And I've even read an interesting piece by a journalist. And you know, a lot of it has to do with the generation. This was a guy in his 40s, and he was saying that he used to love picking up the New Yorker or the Atlantic and reading, you know, a 10-15 page article, but that he just can't do it anymore. And that he feels guilty about it. And so I think we're just all used to reading in these little short bursts, and you know, there's so often you'll find something online and it'll say 2-minute read, or
yes, I know,
or 30-second read, or and I also think people are always going to crave literature. They're always going to crave good writing,
no doubt about it. Yeah, I always wonder, you know, you said those 2-minute reads, like, according to whom?
Right, I know that.
Like, would she read faster than I would? Oh man, who are some of your inspirations? Who are some of the writers? What are some of the books, the stories, the poems that kind of catapulted you into becoming a writer in general? And continue to inspire you.
Yeah, I would say the novel Edith Wharton.
Okay,
the novelist Edith Wharton. I just was obsessed with her work in college. I just love her novels, and especially Ethan Frome, a really sad novel about a man in an unhappy marriage with a domineering wife. And And then Dickens, just his storytelling and his dialogue. I read tons and tons of Dickens. I love Austen. These were all people I read a lot when I was in college. More recently, I've really studied ZZ Packer. She was a Bay Area. I'm not sure if she's still in the Bay Area, but she's just an amazing writer. And her short story, Drinking Coffee Elsewhere, I've taught many, many times. And I've used it with students to like walk through how to do good dialogue, how to subtly show something. So, and then I'm reading Elizabeth Strout, who wrote Olive Kitteridge. I don't know if you've I've read everything she's written, and I'm now reading her new book, which is called Olive Again. And really loving that.
That's awesome. You mentioned dialogue. That seems to me to be one of my number one weaknesses. It's so difficult for me. In the story we're about to talk about, your story called All Sweet Things Float, you know, the dialogue is very realistic. Do you have any tips for dialogue? Is it just,
I think
it's troublesome.
I guess a couple things. One would be to listen. I mean, we get better at writing dialogue if we listen to people talking. But the other thing is that the way people really talk, like 90% of the time, readers wouldn't really want to hear that because we get, you know, we're repetitive. We have, we say, ah. And so what I really encourage students to do is to really write long scenes of dialogue so that they can get to what they want to say, but then go back and chop, chop, chop. Okay. Because dialogue that's in fiction, it often is how we kind of think people talk, but maybe not how they really talk because it doesn't have the gaps and the ahs and the uhs.
Right. You mean literally break it up. You mean literally break it up like ellipses and.
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, cut a lot of dialogue. Okay. What often happens, like, I do a couple lessons on writing scenes and using dialogue. And what often happens is a student will write like a 3-page scene with dialogue, 3 or 4 pages. And then I'll say, okay, get rid of half of this. And then I'll show them techniques. And now look how you're kind of repeating the same thing here. Or I try to tell them only make a scene with a lot of dialogue if it's doing more than just revealing information. And then there are, like, Tobias Wolff is a brilliant, he's a master of dialogue. And so I also just tell the students to study, go look at, you know, look at scenes really, really carefully and look at how a writer shows conflict. You know, look at how it's not just two people arguing and repeating themselves, but look at how one person walks away briefly or someone tries to change the subject or... Right. Or we get an interruption because the cat jumps up and vomits on the rug or something. So I think,
That is very helpful. What are you working on yourself these days? You talked a little bit about some of the smaller projects. Do you have any bigger projects or?
I'm working on a novel, with shifting points of view, a 13-year-old girl and a mother who, has hoarding behavior.
Oh, wow.
And it's set in, the Santa Cruz Mountains. And I'm pretty excited about that project. I've done a huge amount of reading about, people who have that kind of hoarding behavior and, it's an interesting project and that's what I'm working on.
Do you give yourself deadlines or it's like, hey, whenever it's done, it's done?
You know, I did this thing for a while and I would really like to get back to it and COVID just kind of blew that up. But I would get up the night before, I would set myself something that I was going to do connected to the novel. You're going to write the scene with the girl in the library. Cause I knew that I wanted this girl to be someone who hung out in the library a lot. And so then in the morning I would wake up and I would get coffee, but I wouldn't do anything else. I wouldn't take a shower. I'd be in my PJs at my computer with my coffee. And then I'd write that, I'd try to write that scene of the girl at the library.
Oh, nice.
And then sometimes the night before I'd be too tired to give myself an assignment, but I'd still get up and just write. I mean, once I wrote about the shadows that I saw, and that kind of turned into something. And then a lot of times I would write, and it would be, you know, like what Anne Lamott says, shitty, rough draft.
Yes.
So you can call it a draft, but I'm really longing to get back to that more regular kind of writing. And then what I would do is then sometimes I would come back later in the day to, you know, to write in a more systematic way where I'm not in that half dream state.
I referenced that Anne Lamott piece on an earlier episode.
Oh, that's great.
I love it.
Isn't she? Boy, what a writer.
And what is it? Some of the best writing advice ever was what? Keep your butt in the chair.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's so true. Yeah.
I want to talk about the story. I'll think how sweet things float. And so it was published in 2003. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
And in the Prairie Schooner.
Yeah.
Is that University of Nebraska's?
Yes.
Journal? Okay.
Yeah.
And it can be found online. I'll share the post on my website.
Okay.
Has it been anthologized? I'm sure that there was a print edition. Do you have copies of that print edition?
Oh yeah, here I'll show you. I know.
Yeah. All right. That's cool.
Here it is. Yeah.
With so much going online these days, it's great to have that hard copy, right?
Oh, I love having this hard copy. Yeah.
That's great.
And in fact, I didn't even know the story was available online. I was thrilled when you found it and I forget
when
you found it. But
what how long did that take from, let's say, submission to publication?
Probably about a year and a half.
Oh wow.
I'd say.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow. It's a long process with literary magazines.
Yeah.
Sometimes a magazine, this didn't happen to me with Prairie Schooner, but sometimes a magazine will hold on to a writer's work for 16 months and then reject it.
Oh man.
That's I think why people do multiple submissions so often.
Right.
Because oh, some definitely. Magazines take a long time.
Well, I love the story so much. You know, particularly the ending, but there's so much good stuff throughout. We'll kind of go throughout the story a little bit, mostly in chronological order, and just kind of, I have a couple questions and I'd love to hear your comments. Like I said, we get to hear from the actual writer. Early on in the story, I want to say that it was Ruth who's the main character. She's singing or she's humming Music Man. And I mean, to me, it's such a small thing, but I just wonder as a wannabe writer and such, like, why did you pick that? Is that something that we should be like, oh my God, there's so much symbolism, or just that's something
no,
you came up with?
I was in a lot of musicals when I was a kid, and so I often sing music for musicals. And so that it was just something that came to mind. Some of these details I really sweated over, but that was a pretty quick one, just that I knew I wanted. And I wanted something sort of upbeat with this character. I think she's someone who would be humming something kind of upbeat. I was thinking about 76 trombones, you know, that song.
Okay.
That's kind of in my head.
It's funny sometimes, I think, how the readers can maybe overdo the symbolism, especially as a teacher.
Yeah, oh, sure.
Right? I'm in touch with Raina Grande. She's a writer.
Oh, God, she's a wonderful writer.
A wonderful writer, right? Across 100 Mountains is her novel that we read. This was 6 or 7 years ago when I was teaching in SoCal, and she was able to come, I think, 2 or 3 years in a row and speak to the students.
Oh, that's great.
You know, so awesome for them to ask their questions and such. And she, one of the characters' name is Luna. His last name is Luna. And a lot of the book is about the double, you know, like the two-face identity of people, if you will. And so I'm teaching it as, oh yeah, his name is Luna. You know, it means the moon and two sides of the moon. And we asked her that question. She's like, no, I just picked the name. So,
but it's cool. It's cool though when readers can bring their own interpretations to.
Totally.
I mean, that's what we want.
Totally. I was impressed with how well you did nature, if you will, in the story. Even just the garden that you talk about that separate, or the, you know, the garden that in Ruth's house. What was your thinking on how you described the backyard, the the Quiet Place, the Oasis, that kind of thing.
My mother loved gardening, and she always had a lovely flower garden. And I have always felt guilty that I have not inherited that gardening gene. And so I actually had to do research to see what different varieties of sunflowers were for this. So that idea of the garden being peaceful really came from the fact that my mother loved gardening. My mother was a pretty unhappy woman, and gardening gave her a lot of peace.
Yeah. Later on in the story, you talk, it never comes to fruition, but you talk about how Ruth is thinking that she and Antonella, the woman who loses her son, that they can have a relaxing time in the garden. It never comes to fruition, like I said, but.
Right. Yeah.
Am I kind of overreading it to see, or reading it incorrectly to see, maybe like, so the Bellini family are the ones who lose their 2-year-old son to drowning, correct?
Yeah.
And then it seems to me like Ruth, is that kind of like the WASPy family compared to like the big Catholic Italian family?
Yeah. You got that totally.
Yeah.
And that contrast between the two families is sort of the crux of the story.
Right.
For me.
7 kids and the families that, you know, wow. Yeah, it's a beautiful little reminder of, is that Ruth finds a little pull toy of Tony, who was the 2-year-old who died. You do a good job of, I mean, you don't overtell it, but it seems to me like basically poor Tony, 2-year-old, got into the pool while the family was having a party.
Yeah.
It just kind of, everyone was, you know, nobody's fault. It just kind of happened, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And there was actually, an Italian American family who had, I don't know how many kids they had, but they did have a drowning. One of their children drowned. And this was when I grew up in a big Catholic family. We've got 6 kids in our family, and I've never forgotten that this family lost the child, that way. And then there was another drowning in the family, like some years later. And that's just always haunted me. And so I think that was part of something, you know, that was in my psyche when I wrote the story.
Wow.
And my process for writing this story is different than any story I've ever written.
Well, yeah, tell me about that a little bit.
Actually, just for the inspiration of it. Well, I was at Lake Tahoe on a family vacation with all my siblings, their children, and spouses. So it was a pretty big group, and I was floating on a little raft with my sister, and I was looking down at the really clear water of Lake Tahoe, and then all of a sudden I just said to my sister, wouldn't it be cool if there was a short story about a little boy who drowns and the next door neighbor finds his toy and she becomes kind of obsessed with his toy. And my sister said, oh yeah, I guess that would be cool.
Right.
But for some reason, being in the water there, looking at the water, and then I was acutely aware of my unhappy marriage. And how I wish that my family had the dynamics that my siblings had in their families, as people were swimming and playing on the beach and barbecuing. I was acutely aware of the fact that, you know, that I was in a really unhappy marriage, and that there was an affection that, my siblings had in their marriages. And so I think that was probably a big piece of what was in me, like when I was floating on that raft, maybe, in this story.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. You do a great job with the showing rather than telling with the marriage, right? I mean, it's pretty clear that Ruth and Howard don't have a great marriage. There's no abuse. There's no, nothing that's overt, but, he just seems like he's more apathetic than anything else. Is that a pretty good?
Yeah, point? I'm really glad that came across. I did not want him to be an awful man at all. And I even wanted him to show, have some moments of tenderness, like when he brings her the cup of coffee when she's outside.
Right.
That's a pretty empty marriage.
Right. The So you talk about like the drop of water. So Ruth is thinking back to a cruise and she pictures this drop of water that could be, you know, might end up 50 miles away the next day, that kind of thing. And then you talk about the floating woman as part of like a magician's trick.
Yeah.
Is that kind of like about Ruth's desire to escape the marriage, her life?
Yeah, exactly. It's that she sees in the floating woman a kind of peace,
mm-hmm.
That she doesn't have. And she sees in the floating woman too, like mystery. And Ruth doesn't have any mystery in her life. She and her husband live a really predictable life. And I tried to create a sense that she was a really anxious person who had to always be in control of things. But there's this part of her that is kind of longing for things that are different. And I mean, that's probably why she's such a good gardener, is that you know, she grows these flowers. And yeah, you can control flowers a little bit, but not really.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so the floating woman was representing all of that. And then the drop of water, this sense that Ruth isn't really connected to anybody in any real way, not her daughter, not her husband. Mm-hmm. And what she does constantly, she projects, she sort of projects her feelings into objects like the pull toy. And so the water, it's sort of like, yeah, it's a single drop of water, but look how it's connecting with, it's part of all these other drops of water. It's traveling. And, you know, Ruth doesn't, of course, she doesn't really know that about herself.
Right.
But that, as for me as a writer, that was my sense, that that's kind of what her psyche's doing.
Well, you do such a good job with the mother-daughter relationship, where, you know, Samantha, the daughter, she's not mentioned much, but you talk about predictability. She being Ruth, has said, hey, my daughter's coming home. Like, at least there's something I can count on.
Yeah, yeah.
Go to dinner with such and such family. And the daughter just seems kind of, the daughter seems, you know, she's too busy. She can't make it. And her line is something like, I can't take it, mommy. I can't take it, mom.
Yeah.
Right? Are you?
Ruth is very passive aggressive.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's clear the daughter loves her work. She's really buried in it. And Ruth is, the message she gives her daughter when she talks about, oh, we're going to have a dinner party with the blah, blah family. And, oh, did you know their daughter's 6 months pregnant? And she's clearly saying, hey, when are you going to get pregnant?
Right.
When are you going to get married? So I think that the daughter just has had it with her mother being domineering, but in this kind of passive aggressive way.
Yeah, I love how you added that detail, how she segues into, oh, you know, you could be having kids too. And yeah, right. And I also love the detail of, you write something about how Ruth starts off by telling her daughter about Tony's drowning.
And yeah.
And she even gets a little bit of happiness, if that's the word, of kind of like shocking her daughter, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I thought that was kind of like, I mean, that goes with your passive aggressive idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, that her daughter gives her some attention.
Yeah.
With that.
Exactly. Yeah. You can picture her probably at least looking up from her paperwork or something.
Right.
You know?
I'm really obsessed with, mother-daughter relationships in my writing. Mm-hmm. And that was something, yeah, that was interesting for me to work with.
So you talked about the pull toy, and so she finds that, and she's not sure the right way to give it to Antonella, the mother, right? And so she keeps it, she washes it. You said she has an obsession with it. She ends up sleeping outside one of those nights, kind of, she's having a night where she can't sleep, obviously, and she ends up sleeping on, like, the lawn chair.
Yeah.
That's where you talk about that nice moment where her husband has given her some coffee, I think, or put a robe on her over the night, right?
Yeah.
It does, so she wakes with a more optimistic feeling. She compares her pain to Antonella's pain and says kind of like, oh, geez, that's so minor compared to what she's going through.
Yeah.
So she decides to go over to Antonella's house, right? To bring her some food and hopefully cheer up a little bit.
Right.
Again, another detail, but it seems like you have her putting a calendar in her pocket when she goes over there. Is that?
She's hyper organized.
Okay.
And so her thought is that they'll say, yeah, next Wednesday at 3 o'clock, we'll have tea in my garden.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Write it down.
I appreciate that. And I guess that goes with the fact too, that she gets into so much of the minutia of like how to cook it, what to cook, put in the oven for this temperature, when it's like, I'm sure that's also a way of her kind of distracting her own self, right?
Yeah, because she's still sort of steeped in the sorrow of her daughter not coming and what that represents, and the fact that her daughter hung up on her, and she's ashamed that she fell asleep outside, and so she's really trying to make herself feel good about herself by helping this woman next door, who she in her head thinks of as being have completely falling apart and needing Ruth to come and bolster her spirits. And by God, that's what Ruth's going to do. She's going to be a good friend, even though she barely knows the woman.
What a great segue. Like you said, so she goes over to Antonella's house. The kids are all over the place. It's very quiet. But like you said, you know, Ruth seems to think like she's going to be the one, the savior, but she freezes up when she gets there as if she's the one in pain. And Antonella says something to the effect of, are you okay? Right. So the definite role switch there.
Yeah. It's just, she expects the house to, she's made such a big deal in her head about the importance of the pull toy to Antonella and how she'll deliver it and how she'll make Antonella feel better. And so then when she goes in, nothing is the way she thought it would be. And that moment of amazing tenderness where she sees Antonella's daughter combing her hair so tenderly and so gently, and then she sees the family pictures mm-hmm. everywhere. And we would suspect that Ruth's family doesn't go backpacking. And she sees, you know, all these smiling family pictures. And she's jolted. She's really jolted.
Right. Yeah. And we'll come back to that. The idea of the combing of the hair, like you said, is so sweet, so precious. I mean, you write it as Ruth pretty much quickly gives the food and is out of there, right? When she planned a much longer trip.
Yeah.
I guess she kind of answered why the trip was cut, why the visit was cut so short. She just was shocked, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was all so different from how she thought it would be. And probably a psychologist would say that in a way she was going to fill her hunger for the intimacy with her daughter with this intimacy she would create with Antonella.
Sure.
You know, oh, here's this food for you, dear. How are you doing? You know, they would hug. She had this whole, you know, she's a, not an unkind woman, Ruth. Mm-hmm. You know, she volunteers. She's the kind of person though, who has real difficulty being authentic and being in touch with what she really feels.
How incredible is language? You said she's not an unkind woman.
Yeah, so, I know.
The same as saying she's kind.
No, it isn't. It isn't. Right? I couldn't say she's kind, but yeah.
I love it.
I tried to make her super complicated. Mm-hmm. In some ways she's drawn on my grandmother. In some ways she's got small parts of my mother. She was a really fascinating character to create. I loved giving her lots of different layers.
Definitely. Would you feel comfortable reading the last lines?
Sure, I would love to. Yeah.
it's up to you where to begin, but maybe what I guess would be the last two paragraphs that starts with back home.
Sure.
So this is right after, well, I mean, it's self-explanatory. Yeah, whenever you're ready.
Yeah, okay. Back home, Ruth leans against the kitchen sink, drinking a glass of ice water. Her chest is tight, and it's hard to breathe. She closes her eyes and tries to drink more slowly. When she finishes the water, she runs her fingers through her hair. She can't capture any feeling. She tries again. What must it feel like to have someone brush your hair like that? She plucks a hair from her head and looks at it. Poor hair. Hundreds of hours at the hairdressers for shampoos, coloring, cuts. But it's never really been touched. Life, she thinks. What in God's name do you do with it? She stands there a long time, the single hair cupped in her hand.
Wow. I actually quoted that line a couple of days ago to a family member, the life, she thinks, what in God's name do you do with it? And obviously that last line, she stands there for a long time, the single hair cupped in her hand, is so visual. So visual. Does it get you choked up a little bit?
Yeah, it does reading it. And I also remember so vividly how hard it was to write the last few paragraphs. I couldn't figure out how to have the story end once she returned from, I was pretty happy with it up until her walking back to her house. And then I had all these other endings that I wrote that I wasn't satisfied with. And then I finally came up with this one.
Was it kind of trial and error? It just stuck, or?
Well, I just felt, I felt that I needed to do something with the pull toy at the end. And so I had her burying the pull toy. I had her burning the pull toy. I had her taking an axe and chopping it up. I had her wrapping it up and putting it in her basement. And then I thought, why does she have to do anything with the pull toy? Like, yeah. Why? And once I gave myself permission to stop thinking about the pull toy, like then I was able to come to this. And I also tried to be Ruth. I went into my kitchen and I knew she was going to get a glass of water, because that's something in my family. We always, like, when things are upset, when things are, oh, let's get you a glass of water. So I totally knew she was going to do that. So I went in my kitchen with this glass of water and I just stood there for a really long time after I had decided I wasn't going to have her burn the pull toy or bury it or whatever. And then somehow standing there with a glass of water and sipping it, somehow that ending came to me, the real ending.
Yeah. Yeah, just, I mean, I think we as readers learned way back that, you know, there's a lot of times endings aren't really endings.
Yeah.
And so there's that image of her just kind of frozen there and who knows what she does next. It's not like everything wraps up neatly and
right.
It's
shitty,
right? I mean, that's not realistic, like life.
Right, right.
Yeah. Thank you so much again, Claudia.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
What a treat for me and for the listeners to hear from you and to get such an eyewitness view of the writing life and of this particular story, this beautiful story in particular. And again, on my end, I want to thank you for introducing me to such incredible literature, different ways of thinking, and innovative and genuine ways of teaching. Thank you again so much.
You're welcome, Pete. It was a real pleasure.
What a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to Episode 9, All Sweet Things Float. I hope that you'll go to the podcast homepage at chillsatwillpodcast6.podbean.com and like this episode and subscribe to the website. This is a podcast done as a labor of love, and I'd appreciate you recommending my podcast to family and friends who you think would enjoy this long look at chill-inducing literature. You can also follow me on Twitter at chillsatwill, P-O, the number one. At chillsatwill, P-O, the number one. On Instagram, it's at chillsatwill podcast. So until next time, have a great week, and may you find that literature, your own All Sweet Things Float. that gives you chills at will.